The SEC had enacted the tar sands rule because it wanted investors to know when a company was engaged in mining and when it was engaged in oil production. For one thing, the expense of mining was typically higher than the expense of oil drilling, so the value of tar sands reserves over time might be less than an equivalent amount of purer oil. Raymond thought this was wrong, too. The purpose of SEC regulation was to ensure accurate documentation of resources, not to force companies to dance around in outmoded categories devised by bureaucrats. There was no doubt that Exxon owned the Canadian tar sands resources it claimed. Outright fraud was not the issue. In any event, if Exxon's Canadian tar holdings were included with other oil and gas holdings, the corporation's total proved reserves had indeed gone up during 1997, not down. And this is what Raymond chose to emphasize to tell Wall Street and the public. Did his defiance of the SEC rules matter? Raymond might disagree with the regulations on the books, but the purpose of SEC regulation was to ensure that all investors had accurate information about the companies whose shares they owned. Through fraud-inflated bubbles, Wall Street reminded the world every 10 or 20 years why such regulation was vital. Raymond declared publicly each winter in press releases and Wall Street presentations that Exxon enjoyed smooth, year-to-year reserve replacement when, in fact, no such picture existed, according to SEC regulations. And the corporation's spinning did help to mask a strategic issue at Exxon, the challenge of resource nationalism and reserve replacement, which was of genuine and enduring importance. On December 31, 1996, Exxon stock traded at $24.50 per share. On February 6, 1998, the day after the corporation issued a press release boasting of the fourth year in a row that we've exceeded 100% replacement, Exxon shares closed at $31. Exxon's profitability was unchallengeable, but it could be questioned whether all of that 10% plus annual gain in stock price, which benefited Exxon executives and employees as well as ordinary shareholders, was honestly earned. Raymond's defiance of the SEC was not illegal. The corporation's annual 10-K filings to the commission appeared to be carefully parsed, and they broke out tar sands, or oil sands, as a separate reserve figure in fine print. Rule 410 enforced disclosures in official filings to the commission, not in press releases or oral statements to Wall Street analysts. Exxon's practice of reserve spinning to the public reflected a broader mindset of chutzpah toward Washington. The commission staff was by far the weaker party in this particular contest. For many years, the SEC did not have a single oil geologist on its payroll to assess the proved reserve claims made by the oil corporations it oversaw. Exxon's argumentative press releases also signaled how heavily the reserve replacement conundrum apparently weighed on Raymond and his colleagues. The underlying challenge of reserve booking did have far-reaching consequences. It would draw Exxon to far-flung corners of the earth in pursuit of reportable reserves the corporation might previously have ignored on the grounds that they involved too much risk and dragged the company into dictatorships and other violent settings for which it was not well prepared. "What is the one item that concerns you most, that disturbs your sleep?" the Wall Street oil industry analyst Fuddle Gate recalled asking Raymond over a meal. "Reserve replacement," Raymond had replied. John Brown ascended to become chief executive of British Petroleum 2 years after Lee Raymond took over Exxon. As individuals, their personal interests could hardly have been more disparate. Brown, the Soho-inspired gourmet. Raymond, the duck hunter and country club golfer. As business competitors, they faced a common challenge. As Brown put it later, "We believed governments of oil-producing nations would increasingly prefer to work with very big and influential oil companies. They did not think small was beautiful. That was clear when you spoke to them. They wanted to see a big balance sheet, global political clout, and technological prowess, and they wanted to be sure that you would be around for a long time." Moreover, the geographical distribution of Exxon and British Petroleum's oil holdings increasingly isolated those two companies from the regions with the most promising new opportunities. About 80% of Exxon's reported proved oil reserves lay beneath the United States, Canada, and Europe. Exxon's reserves and those of British Petroleum were the most heavily weighted toward the politically safe, economically free, but geologically mature oil regions of the West. British Petroleum had struck out aggressively in the former Soviet Union after communism's collapse, but about three-quarters of its assets remained in Britain and the United States. Chevron had acquired sizable reserves in Kazakhstan and Africa. Mobil owned large holdings in Africa and Asia. The majority of its reserves lay outside of North America and Europe. In the autumn of 1996, at the Four Seasons Hotel in Berlin, John Brown presented a plan to British Petroleum's board of directors, in which he argued that BP should seek a merger with another large international company in order to compete with state-owned oil companies and improve the geographical diversity of its oil holdings. Brown's first choice was Mobil. The BP chief regarded his Mobil counterpart, Lou Noto, as a like-minded cosmopolitan. Noto had grown up in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, as the son of a labor organizer. He was a stocky, lively, charismatic business strategist with a sizable ego. He lived in Manhattan and indulged his fondness for cigars, Porsches, and opera. Brown found him to be a warm, friendly person and bon viveur. They smoked cigars together from time to time.